Evident Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth. And when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evident Footprints, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I'll be with you for the next hour on this February the 17th on the West Coast, now February the 18th on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone. We'd like to also welcome all those listening in around the world on Wind Talkers Radio Network, and we appreciate you helping us spread the word of truth. Before we bring on tonight's guest, I'm going to segue right into a very, very spiritual song. It's sung by Andrea Bocelli. Those of you who may be familiar with him know him for his great recordings and his great, fabulous opera work. And there is a song that he recorded, which is actually the title track of an album called Sogno, and this is the title track. Sogno, which means dream.
Dove sarà che sarà? miseria e sei già qua.
Well, that was Andrea Bocelli and Sonio, Dream. And I thought that would be an appropriate song for us to open up our discussion with tonight's guest. He's returned tonight after an in-depth discussion last night about the conspirators' hierarchy, the Committee of 300. And tonight we're going to talk about another publication, Tavistock, The Best Kept Secret in America. I'd like to preface this introduction with a slight comment, because on my own research path, I discovered a group operating out of Chautauqua, New York, and my description and my findings of my research are published in an article I did for the Idaho Observer back in 2007 called Deathbed Confessions, Photos Support Claims That George H.W. Scherf, Jr. Was the 41st U.S. President. And I discussed my findings on the Federal Reserve, some of which I mentioned with our guest last night, and Circuit Chautauqua. This was a traveling social program, much in the order of a traveling circus or a traveling carnival. When I looked at the card files of some of the people who had attended these events nationwide as this group toured the United States, and I had a sneaking suspicion that this group was Nazi-based, and I found names like John Foster Dulles as one of the participants. Of course, this was many years before the creation of the CIA that this occurred, and I saw Randolph Churchill listed there. And I think this group ties in exactly with what we're going to be talking about with tonight's guest. He's a prolific author, and as I already mentioned, he's written a book on the Committee of 300. Tonight we're going to talk about Tavistock with Dr. John Coleman. Dr. Coleman, welcome back to Evident Footprints.
Well, thank you so much.
Well, hopefully you got to hear my comments there. We were having some trouble last night, and hopefully we'll breeze through this. I know that there's much more that we can cover on the Committee of 300. There's no doubt about that. And I really pray that you will come on the show again so that we can go into this in much, much greater detail and more depth. But the Tavistock issue is extremely important. What led you, if you don't mind my asking, to study this organization? And we're talking about Tavistock Institute for Human Studies or Human Relations. It's been called a few different things, but...
Well, in the course of my work on the Committee of 300, I came across certain facts related to the Tavistock Institute, and I wondered who they were, so I began to research again in the British Museum Library and found that this was a group that was actually founded by Lord Holmesworth in Wellington House in London. Of course, it wasn't called the Tavistock Institute. It was really largely a propaganda organization, and it covered the First World War. The idea that Holmesworth got was that the British troops on the front lines, there they fought fixed battles in trenches in the First and Second World War, but what he found was that the British troops were longing for news from home. They were very hungry to have news from home, and nobody could give them any information. The officer class really didn't care about the lower class British army, which made up the bulk of the soldiers, of course, what they call the lower classes. So Holmesworth had the idea that he would instill some cheer into their lives, and he got all the news of local happenings in England, and he published these in his newspaper, and then shipped thousands of copies to the front, so that when the soldiers on the front had time off, they could read all the happenings back home in England. And this really gave them a great deal of a boost, and it was a great exercise in propaganda. It was, in fact, very much cited by the War Office at the time for his work in this regard, and the morale of the British troops on the front was so strengthened by this simple action that he was rewarded all fronts in all sorts of ways. Then he established in Wellington House an organization for strictly working to propagandize principal issues that needed to be known by the public and by the people of England. And this is what he set out to do with great success. The battles that were fought were tough. And much as the British people did not want to go to war in the First World War, nevertheless, they were persuaded by the propaganda coming from Wellington House that this was not only their bounden duty, but a patriotic service towards their country, and that much overworked word, of course, was used extensively. And it turned actually on the phrase of several of the statesmen who had been at certain of the conferences leading up to the war. And, of course, the fact that remains that he capitalized, Harmsworth and his brother capitalized on this, and they then set about making these major issues the source of their propaganda material. And in this manner, they were able to turn the opinion around and get the British people to vote in favor of the war, whereas before that, had been totally and implacably opposed to war with Germany. They thought that the Germans were the friends of the British. After all, they weren't so far removed from each other, culturally and otherwise, and that even Victoria was very much a German. And, of course, that made them feel that they didn't need and should not go to war. There were no reasons that they could see, the ordinary public, why they should be fighting this nation that had never harmed the British in any way whatsoever. And there was a sneaking suspicion among some of the upper classes, or they, as they love to call themselves, that this war was engineered by this Harmsworth family. In fact, this is what actually happened. And so that the British people could see not only that it was, as I said, their patriotic duty, but also it was very necessary and proper for them to do, to go to war. And so they're able to come this huge obstacle of not wanting to fight the German people at all. And, of course, the First World War broke out in 1914 with tremendous casualties. I think the figure was something like 20 million killed in the flower of the nations of Germany and France and England and all of the so-called allies. We were always somehow called the Allies. I'd like to study that one day and find out why that was and why it is. We somehow managed to appropriate the name Allies always for our side. I guess it sounds a lot better. It may have been, of course, a valuable propaganda tool as well. But be that as it may, the British people were persuaded that this was the right thing to do, and war was duly declared on Germany. And really, we know from subsequent history that this was a matter of a trade war. And actually, all wars are economic in origin, the First World War being no exception. And what had actually happened was that the Germans were beginning to produce very much cheaper and better quality goods in Germany after the World War, First World War, and they were outclassing the British. They'd moved into the Danube Valley area, which was up to that point the private preserves, so they thought, of the British exporters, and they were taking over a lot of the markets of the former British manufacturers. And the opinion was the only way to stop this and also make a handsome profit was to go to war, to declare war against Germany. That's really the reason why this war was fought. We know that the king and one of the men with him in his foreign secretary went, did a secret trip to Paris and signed a treaty with France that if ever they were attacked by Germany, that's France, then the British army would come to their aid. Nothing was said that this was in fact an impossible task because they didn't have any means of getting their army into France at all. And there was no way that they could have done this. But and by this means and other devious ways, the British were inveigled into going into this war and with disastrous consequences. huge, enormous cost, but the greatest cost of all was the cost in lives of the flower of the nations. As I said, at the risk of repeating myself, an enormous number of dead, something like 20 million, I think it was.
Yes, and of course, this is not historically published, yet these stories over the past 10 to 20 years have leaked out as refugees leave certain parts of the world for, let's say, greener pastures. They intimate the number in their towns or their cities that were slaughtered. And whether we're talking about Russia or Germany or Poland or Auschwitz or Dachau, Nuremberg, any of these locations that got the majority of the attention historically were certainly Zionist strongholds, I feel. And those that were in league with the Nazis or with the Bolsheviks, that was all plotted out. In fact, I think most of that came from the city of London, didn't it?
It did. But the interesting thing about all this is that we tend to think of the Germans as the propaganda artists, that Herr Goebbels was the one who had the edge on propaganda. But what actually happened was that Avril Harriman's mother, Mrs. Avril Harriman, an extremely wealthy woman, had started a propaganda center in upper New York State and a place called Cold Harbor. And she had sunk millions of dollars into this project and to propagandize different issues and to what she said to educate the people. And she was so successful in this endeavor that it came to the attention of Goebbels and his propaganda ministry in Germany, and they asked permission if they could come over and attend a couple of the sessions. And so they came over to the United States, and they settled in Cold Harbor at various hotels around the place, around this very fine resort place, actually. And they attended all of the meetings, so that then at the end of the sessions, they went back to the propaganda ministry and laid all this all out to Goebbels, and they formed their propaganda ministry and wrapped this around themselves. And for that reason, they were very, very successful in propagandizing the issues of the war, so that it was no longer a trade matter, but a matter of principle, and of, as they said, was of nations. That the flowers, the nations of the West being superior to any others, that's just where the future of the world lay.
Mm-hmm.
In any event, the thing got twisted around, and then when it came to the actual war, the most successful history of propaganda was the German propaganda machine under Goebbels.
Yes. In reference to the article that I mentioned at the top of the show that I had researched, I was speaking with some people who recall seeing what they described as forests of U-boat antennas in the harbor near Montauk, and this would be at night. There was an infiltration that occurred even of the German military. This is how brazen this was. Of course, the average individual didn't do that or wasn't aware of that, but certain people recall seeing this as children in that area of Montauk. And Montauk has been one of the central locations for very advanced mind control techniques and research on some of the technologies of Nikola Tesla. I don't want to deviate. I find that this has occurred in several other places in the United States as well. Some of the military bases, certainly, or some of the national research institutes. And you go into that in detail. So this is an orchestrated effort, in essence. Tavistock is basically putting together this puzzle of mass mind control for the whole planet. Would you say that that's their ultimate goal?
Absolutely. Of course, that was the goal. Certainly, that's what they were aiming at. And for that reason, they were backed by all sorts of financing, and actually the Tavistock Institute was operating out of the north part of England, and then they formed a huge organization in the London School of Economic Grounds, and again they were given an enormous amount of funding to pursue their goals in propagandizing their own nation into war and to persuading the Germans that their cause was wrong and that the Allies was the right cause.
Yes. When would you say, actually, from your research, that this dimension of Tavistock infiltrated the United States? And you outlined some of the universities and organizations that they worked with.
Well, it's difficult to put your finger right on the actual year, although I did give an estimate in the book of where this started occurring. And I will say that it never came to fruition completely until Mrs. Avril Harriman had completed her endeavors. And then it moved from that into the London School of Economics in later years. And I think from there they were carried out very successful forays against their own people and certainly against the German people.
Yes. I find in my research, and I'm just verifying what you're saying here, that certain institutions, certain educational institutions, are up to their eyeballs in this. You mentioned Stanford Research Institute, Esalen, MIT, the Hudson Institute, Heritage Foundation, the Center for Strategic and International Studies at Georgetown University, U.S. Air Force Intelligence, the RAND Corporation, the MITRE Corporation, and then some of the groups that we discussed yesterday, and a few more.
Yes.
Do you
want all appendages of the Tavistock Institute? They were operating. Yes. They had actual infiltration into those institutions, especially Stanford, and places where they could influence the minds of the university students there.
Yes. Now, is this permitted because of the monies that are paid to the institutions themselves? Someone with any amount of conscience would say, wait a minute, you're talking about coming in here and brainwashing our students? Wait a minute, you know, we're not going to allow that. No, it's promoted. It's surreptitiously promoted, but nonetheless, how do you get an entire university or research institute to work for such an evil purpose?
Well, you take the most prestigious institution like the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Boston. I mean, you think this is the blue blood, this would never be able to be corrupted in any way at all. But they certainly had units of the Tavistock in their faculty and also in many of their student bodies. So it's difficult to prevent it. Once this gathers momentum, it's extremely difficult to stop it.
Yes.
And even the people who are responsible for the funding of these universities are not able to put an end to it. They can say, well, we withdraw our funding. But then they're going to have to say why and how, and this is not believable. The general public will say, this is, you know, just a lot of nonsense. Like they told me when I began, they said, you're off the wall, and we don't pay any attention to what you're saying because it's just not credible. But over the years, unfortunately, much of what I said would happen has happened. Not that I'm a prophet or anything like that, but I have had the benefit of tremendous information that's been made available to me. And for that, I was able to put all this stuff together.
Mm-hmm.
Although there is a lady who has a website all about me, and her name is Dee. She said that John Coleman is a modern-day prophet amongst us. And I think that's stretching it too far, but anyway.
Well, you do excellent research. I find that some of the people I was looking at prior or tracking prior to World War II, I discovered where they came into Ellis Island And I found addresses which I determined were buildings on the property of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Here we had a U-boat.
They had shared what they called shared projects.
Mm-hmm.
And we were allowed to go into Russia, but we were actually kept out of the main institutions, like where the armaments were made and the aircraft design. We were kept out of those. We were given minor places in Russia, whereas we opened our major institutions. They gave only the minor institutions. They only gave us access, us being the Americans, minor institutions, nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to get into the Kennedy assassination, but, you know, Oswald was one of those people who were sent to study there, and people looked upon Oswald as just a bit of a misfit and not a person who mattered much. But this man was brilliant. He spoke Russian fluently, he spoke Japanese fluently, and unbeknown to American people, he'd been studying in Japan, and he was in charge of a whole monitoring station there, in intercepting signals out of Russia, as I said, which he spoke fluently, and nobody ever suspected him of anything of that nature. He was portrayed as just a most unreliable person who was involved very much in the assassination of Kennedy, and of course, I don't believe that he was. I don't think he had anything to do with it.
Yes.
And I detail that in my book, The Committee of 300, but I don't want to go backwards into that. I'd rather we stick with the Tavistock Institute now.
Yes, yes. Well, I mentioned what I did about MIT because I thought that was kind of interesting. I researched the number. They had a serial number that was written next to the individual's name, and there were four people on this ship that had arrived, a passenger ship, from Germany through England, and they had these numbers scribbled there, and I did some research on the numbers, and eventually I located an address at MIT, and I said,
yes,
"Wow,
this is
interesting." So
indeed.
I know that research is accurate. There's no doubt about it, but it's nice to hear you chime in that you're familiar with that. Now,
yes, I am.
Yeah, the issue of SRI, the Stanford Research Institute, in more recent times, we'll say in the 70s, this became the focal point of the development and the research going on in conjunction with several Scientologists or higher up in the Church of Scientology, L. Ron Hubbard's group, and a psychic by the name of Ingo Swann, and the development of the remote viewing program. That's gotten all the publicity as the major event that went on at SRI. But today, the National Education Association is run out of Stanford Research Institute. Many people in the school system do not know this or why.
It's amazing how this information has been well hidden, but they have this forward-looking program, and they could actually read the files in the file cabinets in some of these Russian institutions that were totally closed to the public. Strictly only army or Russian intelligence people were allowed into those buildings. And the CIA was able to do forward-looking remote viewing and get into these files and see all of the secrets that the Russians had successfully concealed from us for years.
Mm-hmm.
But again, as I said, when I first started talking about all these things, people thought I was slightly bent, but out of shape, and certainly as I got a call from one man, he said, "I wish you'd shut up and stop talking about stuff you don't know anything about, and I think you're completely off the wall." So that was the kind of answers I used to get back in those days. Since then, people have become somewhat better informed, and they don't immediately dismiss these kinds of information that they don't fully understand with skepticism. They have a more open mind and they're ready to learn about it instead of just dismissing it.
Yes, you do go into the methods which are used, and it's a progression, isn't it?
It is. Yes.
How much of this would you say Freud was responsible? And of course, we're speaking about Sigmund Freud. who was the first, let's say, consultant, if you want to use that term, who was designing these policies that were to be implemented. Can you answer that? Are you familiar with that? Or
I'm familiar with it, but I'm not sure that Mays methods were fully applicable in this instance. I think this came before we ever thought of any reading people's minds or finding out what they were thinking about and influencing them that way. I think this predates all of his research and work.
Mm-hmm.
That may sound a bit strange to you, but my information that I got from credible sources, and especially when I was in England for many, many years, the people that told me this were not people that you could just brush aside or dismiss. They were not given to flights of fancy at all.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Kurt Lewin, who was...
Yes.
An infiltrator. There's no doubt about that. And you pegged him as such. Coming to the United States in 1933, after having been made the director of Tavistock a year before. So
That's right. This
is a plan that was well known then internationally amongst certain groups that were going to participate in this.
That is exactly as I saw it, anyhow.
Now, when we hear about Freud's methodologies in psychology, they talk about these statements that he allegedly made, that mankind is driven by sex, that this is an innate quality, it's inescapable because of his desire to survive and to procreate. So they formed a model of attention to the aspects of sex and all of its aberrations to be released or unleashed upon the public over time. And we see this probably, it's most evident to people in the 60s, where when they had this message of free love with the hippies, and the women would take their bras off, and that was symbolic of some kind of freedom.
The flower children in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
That emanated from that research, which he made public in many ways. And this is what spread to the United States also. It took hold very much in the 60s. One of the most, I would say, the most remembered of those episodes was the flower children in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm. The methods that Freud used, you say, created a permanent or induced a permanent mental illness in those that underwent those treatments. Is this along the lines of the MK Ultra mind control?
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely.
Tell us a little bit about how you came upon this information from your research, from your perspective.
Well, I can't give you too much detail on that because I'm still, I wouldn't say sworn to secrecy, but the people who gave it to me, they extracted a pledge from me that I would never ever divulge the source of this information.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel that it's not very honorable for me, especially on the air, to go and divulge the source of that information, having given an undertaking that I would never do this.
No, certainly I wouldn't ask you to do that. One could surmise that, just with a little bit of basic logic, that probably Freud and Bernays had a little bit to do with that.
Yes, I'm sure.
I'm not so interested in the methods. We know a lot from those that are regaining their early on memories. We're talking about childhood. Some have been able to, because of the fractalization of their mind, and then the recovery of those early memories. Some are even remembering their birth. They've been able to overcome some of the programs, but many are still under the spell, so to speak. They're still programmed and they're called out. They use newspaper articles, crossword puzzles, radio shows, billboards, TV shows, movies, magazines, music. Music plays a big part in that, and I think we should talk about that a little bit. But these people are regaining a lot of their faculties, and they keep mentioning the same names. There's some names that you have written about, Henry Kissinger, George Bush Sr., George H.W. Bush, a.k.a. George Scherf Jr. He's seen Joseph Mengele is another one. And, you know, we've tracked these individuals here in the United States. We know a lot more about where they are than what history has shown us. History's basically been a lie about the whole thing. This truth is coming out. So I said that. You don't have to comment on that if you don't want to. But certainly you mentioned Kissinger. And I'm wondering if maybe you learned that he was assigned the role to basically supervise this operation in the United States.
Well, Kissinger's rise to infamy is a story in itself. First of all, he became known during the Second World War when he became the driver for General Fritz Kramer. And Fritz Kramer used to refer to him in the most unflattering terms. And then he was taken up by people in the United States who saw in him the possibilities of expanding his role and his influence. And he went from a driver for Fritz Kramer to a person much sought out for enlightenment and for explanation of things that he really was not authorized or qualified to talk about. But he made a big impression on everybody. He went from stage to stage until he reached what I call his infamous zenith.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned also some of the programs that occurred in various parts of the military academies. And we know that a lot about what's going on in the Navy, in the Army, in the Air Force, in the Marines. It's basically spread to every branch of the military.
Oh, it has indeed, yes. I'd like to go back to the music aspect of this and mention
sure.
The Beatles, this group that suddenly appeared out of nowhere
mm-hmm.
and was sent to the United States to make this huge impact and sweep away all other groups that were playing songs and singing songs and music were quite acceptable, quite mild, like the Beach Boys. And what the Beatles were discovered by somebody from Tavistock happened to be traveling in Hamburg in Germany, and they have a very seedy and unsavory district there called the Reeperbahn, which is like the red light district of Hamburg. And to have a red light district in Hamburg, it's got to be pretty rotten. So the Beatles were struggling and eking out a living, playing in one of the cellars, which were all downstairs basement-like rooms. And they were playing music, just completely innocuous stuff. And then they were taken from this group, from this environment, and sent over to England and given the most honored treatment, and eventually ended up being in the hands of Theo Adorno, who was a professor of music. And in the beginning, it was Adorno who wrote all of the Beatles' songs. They didn't write any of their own songs or their music. In the latter years of their existence, they did. And John Lennon, having learned from Adorno, was able to turn out some what they would call credible stuff, songs and music, which he actually wrote and composed. So it's safe to say that the Beatles were only partially responsible for their own music and their lyrics.
Yes.
Of course, I've had all kinds of brickbats hurled at me about people who really love the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
And they think this is not the kind of thing that could possibly happen. But that actually is exactly what happened.
Yes. I'm inclined to agree with that from my perspective as a musician and a music composer. You learn. I have the ear even to listen to a song and see what the influence is behind that.
Yes, whether they conveyed a hidden message. Another thing that they used the Beatles for once they began giving concerts. I mean, you can see how this thing was all generated and put together. When they arrived in New York at the airport, there were thousands of young girls on the balcony, and they were all swooning and crying out to the Beatles, "We love you," and yet they'd never ever heard any of the Beatles' music before. It hadn't been played in the United States.
Yeah, they were screaming.
It shows you again the value of propaganda. These girls were paid $20 each, and they were bussed out to the airport, and there they were under control of one of the great music masters, so-called, of the time. And, of course, they put on this marvelous act of swooning and falling down all over each other and saying, "We love you," and they love your music, and "We adore you," and they'd never, ever heard any of this. I never heard the music of the Beatles in the United States. And there again, I want to show you the force of propaganda and what it can do.
Yes.
And well, from that moment onwards, the Beatles were sensational, a sensation in the United States. And they mm-hmm. completely wiped off the map all these other groups that were really played good music and sang good lyrics.
Yes. Many of those, Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons was a very popular group that took a back seat. And they started promoting other British groups as well, the Dave Clark Five and Herman's Hermits. And we started getting into this really strange infiltration of British rock music, which was basically them copying various styles of music that were indigenous here in America.
It's worth noting that all of the groups that came out after the Beatles, that followed the Beatles, like the Rolling Stones, for instance, their music and their lyrics became more and more decadent. Actually, Mick Jagger, the leading man in the Rolling Stones, was a very fine English gentleman, spoke with a very good accent, what they call an upper-class accent, and was a person of high social standing. But he had decided to take on this role, and when people saw him acting, they thought, "Well, this guy is really the most decadent person we've ever seen." And the groups grew more and more decadent and more ugly and more disreputable, one after another. And here's the point worth noting. They all came out of England, all of them.
Yes, I sort of remarked that, about that. Not with the conviction you did, but I referenced some of those groups. When I lived in Switzerland, I had the opportunity to work with Jimmy Duncombe of Jimmy and the Rackets, and he was an excellent guitar player, and he was basically playing American music. They were very popular. He told me that in England, they were actually more popular than the Beatles. The Beatles were the phenomenon here. And certainly mass mind control, round-the-clock radio play. Every station was playing their music. And they would come out with a song, and suddenly the song is number one in 2 days or 3 days, or sometimes it took a couple of weeks, but they always had a number one. And I found their association with George Martin, who was their producer, and the orchestrator and arranger and even engineer on many of their projects was put there. But I suppose it was because of his ability to adapt what they were trying to accomplish to that music and to those productions.
Well, that had another purpose too. They had these concerts, and they turned out to be enormous affairs with thousands and thousands of these young people coming to the concerts. And that while the concert, while the music was going on, they had their agents moving them through the crowd and giving away free little packages of LSD and other drugs.
Mm.
So to give you an idea how what a grip this propaganda machine had. And I said in the beginning, this was definitely a science, and they had it down to a fine art.
Yes. There are some stories about Brian Epstein. Certainly one question I always asked, I was quite familiar with the music and the drumming of Pete Best, who was the original drummer. For some reason, they pulled him from the group. Do you have any background as to why? Now, he's gone on to have quite a successful career as a music composer and producer, arranger. He scored music for some movies. He was the real musician out of the whole group. I'm wondering why they took him out of the group. Do you have any information in that regard?
I don't, but I would suppose that was the old reason. He began to buck the instructions that were given to him, and when he didn't want to obey the instructions, that's when they pulled him out.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's a you're familiar with Ken Adachi. Ken has studied the issue of Paul McCartney. There was a recording session that Paul was late to, and they had made contact with Brian Epstein, and he went to get Paul. And they, to be brief with the story, they never came back. And yet Paul was replaced sometime after that, and that was allegedly over his affair with Sylvie Martin. Evidently, her husband found out about it and complained to someone, and they removed Paul. They took care of the both of them. The Ken's research says that they were thrown out of an airplane. So we know they have the technology and the arts to change the appearance of an individual. Supposedly, he was replaced with someone who was good at imitating his voice, was trained at imitating his voice, and they made him look like Paul through possibly some plastic surgery. But I find it rather strange that when the Beatles broke apart, they weren't destitute in the sense of having enough money to live, but they didn't get the musical fulfillment out of other projects that they worked on, maybe with the exception of Ringo Starr, because he worked with some other artists over the years as a stand-in drummer. Any thoughts about that? Because
I think they did get financial fulfillment. I don't know about anything else, because you take John Lennon, for instance. He was living in a block of apartments in New York. It cost $24,000 a month to stay there.
Mm-hmm.
And you couldn't do that. That's where he was staying with Yoko Ono, that Japanese girl that he married. And that's not small potatoes at all.
No, it isn't. And then Paul McCartney, he married Linda Eastman, and then ended up splitting up and really having a tough time reestablishing himself. It is though they turned the back on the individuals. It was the group that was the issue. They really didn't care about the individuals afterwards.
No, I think that's pretty obvious about when you examine exactly what happened to them. But financially, they were all well and well taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
They may have been not acceptable in some circles. I can understand that, especially the powerful family like the Eastmans, which I would certainly say you don't cross those kind of people at all. And just by divorcing or leaving his daughter, I think he certainly marked himself as a candidate to be ostracized.
Mm-hmm. Certainly. And there are George Harrison dying of cancer, John Lennon being murdered.
Assassinated, murdered.
Yes. There was a grudge there. Now, there were some cryptic messages left on some of the album covers, denoting that Paul was gone, that Paul had been replaced. And I find that kind of interesting. And not that we have to spend a lot of time on that, but they spend all this time, all this money, developing a program that they're going to unleash upon the whole world. And in some senses, some of the music is classic stuff. It's really good material. But I personally didn't see them writing a lot of it in the beginning. In the later years, yes, I did.
That's what I said earlier. Earlier years, they didn't. They wrote all their own music and lyrics, but later years, it was all done by other people. And except for John Lennon, he did very well with that. He wrote a lot of his own music and lyrics.
Yes. I got to visit some of the studios where their music was recorded. Of course, Abbey Road Studios. The speakers were phenomenal.
Well, you know what's happening. You see these kids go to London and walk across the Abbey Road like some sacred piece of earth. They do it today. In fact, a group especially go on vacation to London and from Japan and all over the place. And so good is the propaganda that mm-hmm. they've entrenched into the minds of these people that this is a thing to do.
Yes.
And so you see them crossing Abbey Road, one behind the other, like the Beatles did.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is just a dumb thing, and I think it's a marvelous, something like going to the Vatican and meeting the Pope.
Yes. Well, my reason wasn't to gawk. It was business. But I found it interesting, the way that they recorded. And back then, they had two-track and then three-track machines. And then finally they got into four-track recordings. So they did a lot of bouncing of the tracks to add more sounds to the recordings. We just didn't have the technology back then, or it wasn't available to the average recording studio. But
I think that's more accurate. It wasn't available to mm-hmm. the recording studios. I believe the technology was certainly there, certainly around, but mm-hmm. I don't think it was given to the recording studios.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and it's always happened in phases. They've released upgrades in the equipment. I grew up in the days of analog recording, and I used virtually every mixing console and recorder on the market. And even when Paul McCartney left the group and started his own group, he was still using the Studer A80 recorders, these monstrous towers of electronics that sat on the top of the machine. That you could make all of these intricate bias adjustments and Dolby noise reduction and very expensive machines. Not every studio had those machines back in those days. So there was a lot of money behind that project. That's the point I'm making. And they stuck with that equipment. They used that same equipment whenever they could in their other projects. But as electronics became smaller and the computations that were necessary to accommodate more information, and as they reduced the size of the equipment, they integrated digital electronics.
That's analogous to the computer. If you remember the early pictures of the computers, they were giant machines, big mm-hmm. square blocks lined up next to each other. And then what do we have today? The development has been so rapid that today the computer is just a tiny little machine, certainly nothing like it was when they began. I mean, some of those IBM computers were just gigantic, big square boxes filling up the whole room. It had to have special computer rooms behind the closed doors. And today, of course, the evolvement has been tremendous, until you have the miracle of these small little computers, which contain a good deal more than the old ones used to.
Mm-hmm. Now, staying on the topic of music, I've noticed the progression. And as I said, you know, I grew up playing acoustic instruments, learning them, reading notes, writing the whole ball of wax. So when we talk about the range of an instrument, I can tell you what that is. I can write the parts out for that instrument, and they'll sound correct. And even
sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead. Yeah.
I was going to say, there came a point where suddenly music was on the verge of becoming synthesized. There were a few manufacturers who were making synthesizers, and I always questioned why they were doing that. It's an interesting sound. In fact, I'm quite an expert in synth programming, but I always strive to produce natural tones rather than technological tones that dehumanize a person. And I see that as you were describing some of the sound equipment, the original synthesizers developed by Robert Moog, for example, were huge, and they used patch cables like a telephone operator would use for the telephone company. They would plug a voltage-controlled amplifier into another device and keep adding oscillators to this. And it was accepted as something a bit different, but you had the purists that fought that. Then music became sort of, it was as though they were mocking the whole musical experience. You would go to Las Vegas to listen to a singer, and suddenly the last time you went to hear a performer, they had a whole orchestra, and now they were playing to pre-recorded music. And they dehumanized the whole experience. You had the star there, certain stars that had established names, Wayne Newton or Elvis Presley, would just demand that they wouldn't use recorded music, that they'd have a live band or an orchestra. But there were some individuals who were forced to start using these pre-recorded backing tracks, they're called. And then over a period of time, several acts that they put out, I remember there was one called Milli Vanilli, if you remember that.
Oh, yes, I remember that.
And they got, they were using a digital audio tape recorder, a DAT machine, and the machine probably had dirty heads, and what was happening is it would read so far and it would automatically reset itself, and it kept repeating the same line over and over. And they basically psychologically fell apart on stage. The secret was out.
I could understand that. You know, with your superior knowledge of music, I wonder if you can explain to me how it was that the guitar, which the electric guitar, which has a very limited range of sound and expression, how it became to be the most played instrument in the world, probably. I mean, you take a magnificent instrument like a pipe organ with a huge range of sound, and you wonder how it could be compared to the electric guitar, which there's no way that you could have any range in it at all. They had sort of things on that twanged it up and down and made it sound a bit wobbly, but that's about all.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't for instance, play anything with wild, like Purcell's trumpet ball entry or something like that on the guitar. It's laughable.
Yes. Well, to answer that in the most logical way, a pipe organ doesn't fit in the trunk or the back seat of the average car.
That's right. But nevertheless, how could the guitar become, apart from that, how on earth did people somehow go to these concerts and be happy with listening to this instrument with a strictly limited range of sound? and spend the whole night there, almost, at least several hours.
Yeah, it depends
on the... One wonders where the interest, where the music came from. What kind of musical range were they trying to listen to? What was the purpose of going to these concerts?
Well, the electric guitar enabled them to introduce a lot of dissonance and distortion into it. So they could manipulate the consciousness and take the higher spiritual vibrations out of the music and make it very animalistic or very basic. This thing of hitting a guitar chord with the volume up and lots of sustain and distortion and a fuzz tone and hitting the chord, that is not music.
Especially when you consider the Spanish guitar, not the electrical, no electrical. The Spanish guitar, beautifully played by a master, was a very nice instrument. You could get some feeling out of it, but this whining and howling of a guitar, electric guitar, is beyond my comprehension. Anybody could listen to that for more than 2 seconds.
Yeah.
Without getting subtly disgusted with it.
Yes, it has its purpose at moments in a movie score or any emotional part of a song that's got a real message in it. But I would agree that a lot of the effects that are used are really to distort the consciousness and to degrade the accomplishments of some of the earlier performers. When you get into the issue of classical guitar, the technique is very demanding. Just to learn to play the music is very, very demanding. An amplifier and a few volume knobs and maybe a bass or a treble filter control, maybe a tone bender that allows them to bend all the strings simultaneously, taking the instrument out of its natural range, are ways to pollute the music. Really, it's a sort of pollution. And there are some out there.
Good explanation you've given me. I know that I used to really love listening to Andre Segovia playing the classic Spanish guitar. I mean, that was a work of art always. Mm-hmm. But this kind of screeching sound they develop with these guitars, that's what gets me.
Well, those attack the psyche and certainly the mind of the individual. And they tend to bring out the animal aspects of the human being. It's a pretty harsh statement I'm making, but...
I think there's a lot of merit to it.
Yeah.
I think it's a very good statement.
Mm-hmm. And it has a negative effect on the individual. I can tell you that I've worked with engineers that used to play those instruments on the stage in Hollywood, and they lost their high-frequency hearing, or they lost their bass hearing, depending on what instrument they played and how often they were exposed to damaging volume levels. You know, the pain threshold, on average, begins at 120 decibels. And some of these groups are playing 200 decibel volume coming out of these amplifiers, and they're standing 2 or 3 feet away from them. So over a period of time, they're destroying the cilia in the ear canal that vibrates, that helps assist us in discerning the frequencies that we're hearing. The ear does all the work, but the cilia. Yeah, they're very, very sensitive. When you're engineering, you have to get up and walk away from the mixer and go outside or go into another room and escape that environment. Otherwise, your hearing shuts down gradually. And then you have to add more volume to the mixing console to cause the speakers to play louder so you can hear what you're not hearing now because your ears are literally shutting down. So there are many rock guitar players walking around half deaf, many engineers that recorded and mixed and mastered their music have gone deaf, and they regret it. But I'll tell people when I'm working with them in the studio, I will not approach the pain threshold in the volume. I will not do that. I will not put unnatural frequencies in the neighborhood of an earthquake, say, for example, in the bass region of the speaker. I just won't do that. It affects our physical makeup. It affects our DNA, even. Now, on some level, they know this, or they wouldn't be manufacturing these devices capable of causing that sort of damage.
I'm sure there's always an ulterior motive behind all of these things. I think this is definitely one of them.
Yes. So we have the, you know, we're talking about how the music is recorded, how it's archived or documented for, whether it's a vinyl record, in the old days it was wax, vinyl, tape, which is a petroleum product, you know, cassette tapes, they had 8-track tapes, reel to reel, 2-inch, 1-inch, 1/2-inch, 1/4-inch. And they learned ways to store data on that tape, which is what they do with the DAT machine. So a DAT machine has the capability of reaching these extreme thresholds of sound that, again, can do damage. The CD and the DVD now with its capabilities can put these extreme volume levels on the equipment. And, of course, boy, if you're going to watch TV... And that's certainly part of the mind control as well. Maybe we could talk about that on an upcoming show. But the mind control aspect of all of this is, well, to really be a good TV watcher, you have to have a huge screen and you have to have 5 or 7 speakers scattered around your room so you feel like you're there. Now, why do I want to be in the middle of a war? Or... some tragic event, but people don't really think about that. They just blindly compete to have these things and to incorporate them into their lives without really considering the damage that they're doing to themselves.
And it's been interesting talking about all of these things tonight, and I thank you for the opportunity of coming on your show, and I'm certain that we can arrange that I do this in some future date, and I'll be in touch with you later, or you can be in touch with me.
Or we can be in touch with each other. Yeah, certainly we can be in touch with each other. I appreciate you coming on the show and sharing this important information. I do want to get into it much deeper because there's a lot more that goes along with this.
Well, that's good. Then we have plenty to talk about in the future.
Yes. Well,
so again, my thanks to you and my gratitude to you for allowing me to be a guest on your show tonight.
Well, I'm honored to have you, and I appreciate you staying up late to appear on the show. We'll try next month. I'm booked up for the month of February, the rest of the month. So that little voice told me to keep these dates aside. Someone new was going to be coming to the show.
That's good. All right. Well, listen, I'll be happy to hear from you then. And again, my thanks and gratitude to you.
All right.
I wish you a very good night.
You too. Folks, that wraps it up. You've been listening to Evident Footprints on bbsradio.com and tonight's guest, Dr. John Coleman. Now, thank you. Okay, you can visit Dr. Coleman's website at Coleman300. That's Coleman300. 300.com. You can order either the book on the Committee of 300 or Tavistock, the best kept secret in America, from his website. I'm sure it's also on Amazon.com. I've seen it in some bookstores over the years as well. So we look forward to having Dr. Coleman on again. Special thanks to Wind Talkers Radio Network for broadcasting Evident Footprints over at BBS Radio, Seth Hendrick on the sound. Want to thank Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible, and most of all, you, the listening audience, for tuning in. Join me tomorrow night when my special guest will be scientist-inventor Jim Murray. In the meantime, I wish everyone a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.